farm policies since the early 1990s, including as a member of the committee that led to a class action suit against Monsanto and Bayer to stop GMO wheat and make them liable for GMO canola contamination of organic farms. Here are Kathy and Gabby in conversation. Take a listen.
So thank you so much for joining us on Rabble Radio today, Kathy.
Yeah, happy to be here.
Just before we get into it, can you explain for our listeners what seed sovereignty is?
Seed sovereignty is basically when farmers have control over their seed, and that's in opposition to having corporations controlling the seed.
So in practice, what does that mean?
Well, one of the major things that seed sovereignty means is when farmers grow a crop and they eat a lot of crops, the actual crop like wheat or oats is a seed in itself. That's what we, you know, grind into flour and cook and make food with. So when you're growing your crop, you're actually growing seeds as well. So sometimes farmers are, you know, actually for thousands of years, farmers have kept those seeds, some of them, and save them for the next year to plant, or even for future years to plant. So you grow your crop, you save some of it back, and you use that for seed. And in the process of saving for seed, often farmers look at, well, which part of my crop grew the best, which are the best seeds. And as you keep planting the best seeds, you improve your crop. And that's how crops are improved for thousands of years. And so when farmers are able to save their seed, they can be confident that they'll be able to grow a crop in the future years. And for other kinds of, like, not grain crops or, like, say, tomatoes and crops that aren't, you know, you're eating the fruit and not the seed, saving seed is a little bit more specialized, but that's what farmers have done for all time. That's actually what agriculture really is based upon. People growing food and recognizing what good seed is, saving that seed, planting another crop, and over time improving the seed through observation and, you know, deciding what you like and what you want. And so that is really the foundation of seed sovereignty. What has happened to affect that is about 100 years ago, the technique of hybridization was developed. So that's taking two quite different varieties and doing a cross between those varieties, and the cross is a hybrid. It's got some of the characteristics of both parents. And then that hybrid seed has also what they call hybrid vigor. It just seems to, you know, be seed that grows really well. And corn was the crop that this was first used on. And when you save the seed from a hybrid corn, you don't get the same thing growing. You get some of the characteristics from that seed's parents, one parent, the other parent, and a combination. So the seed is just not as consistent when you save seed from a hybrid. So once corn was hybridized and farmers realized, well, actually the hybrids produce a better crop than trying to save seed and from a hybrid and plant it, that was a way that seed company, and the one that started this out was called Pioneer, which is still part of the seed system today. They were able to make extra money because they could sell seed every year instead of once in a while, or having farmers just use their own seed all the time. So this, aha, here's a good way to make money. Set up a system where farmers have to buy new seed every year. And, you know, it was good seed, but farmers then became dependent on these companies if they were using that type of seed. And then later on, hybridization was used to promote annual seed sales in other kinds of crops. And then they started working on genetic modification, like canola, corn, and soybeans. There's genetically modified varieties now. And the law allows companies to patent the genes that are used to genetically modify these crops. So if you're using a genetically modified crop, then patent law comes into play. and the company can say, you can't plant this unless you pay us a royalty. And if you plant it without paying a royalty, we're going to sue you. So when that system came in, that really got people into a situation where if they wanted to use the genetically modified varieties, they would have to buy seed every year. And then what we saw happening was the price of genetically modified seeds started rising. And this happened particularly after 2004. There was a really important court case where a farmer named Percy Schmeiser was sued by Monsanto. They claimed that he used their patented seed without permission, and he argued that he didn't. But anyways, the Supreme Court decided that it didn't matter whether he intentionally used those seeds or not. The fact that they were on his farm, that these plants grew on his farm, whether he decided to plant them there or not, he was infringing on Monsanto's patent, and he owed them money. He was sued. So that scared off a lot of farmers from using canola seed that wasn't genetically modified, but could have potentially been contaminated with, you know, GM canola seed might have gotten mixed with their seed for some reason, or maybe cross-pollinated. And so they did not want to be sued. And after 2004, we saw a huge uptake of GM canola seed because farmers did not want to be sued by Monsanto. So now almost all of the canola that's planted in Canada is genetically modified, and farmers have to buy seed every year from the company, and they pay a lot of money for seed. The price of canola seed is very, very high compared to other kinds of seed. And this is because the companies can force farmers to pay it. The only way they can get that seed is if they buy seed from the company every year and pay the royalty. So that's a situation where farmers do not have seed sovereignty at all. They are completely dependent on the corporation. And what the corporations have also done with canola is that they have taken non-genetically modified canola varieties off the market. They've deregistered them. So that makes it so that it's kind of illegal to grow it. You can't sell deregistered canola varieties. So they've not only made it so you have to pay a royalty, but you can't even get non-GM canola, at least not very easily. And because canola cross-pollinates so easily, even if you were to grow non-GM canola, it could cross-pollinate with nearby GM canola, and then you'd be susceptible to being sued. So this is one of the ways that the big seed companies have been able to get control over seed, which makes it so that farmers have to put a lot of the money they earn into buying seed every year. Whereas when you have the ability to save farm-saved seed, like people can if they're growing wheat now, you might buy a certified seed that is, it might cost a little bit more than farm-safe seed, but after you've bought that, you can save some seed and you can plant that on your farm without paying anybody anything. So what we were concerned about when the Saskatchewan Pulse Growers organization decided to make an agreement with a big company, Lima Grain, to use some of the money that farmers pay to support developing pulse crops, and they're giving some of that money to Lima Grain in return for doing some plant breeding and developing some new varieties of pulse crops, lentils and peas. The only way farmers will be able to use those crops is if they sign a contract saying they will not use farm-saved seed unless they tell Lima Grain and pay a fee. So that means they would have to pay for seed every year, even seed that they grew on their own land. And that's a way that farmers' seed sovereignty is taken away. So that's the kind of thing we're concerned about.
Yeah, and it sounds like it's putting a very big cost burden on farmers that wasn't there, you know, 100 years ago, as you were saying. Yeah. And so what does that do to our local food systems?
Well, most of these big companies, they're really interested in the market for crops that are planted on large acres, that there's a large volume of seed sold. Obviously, canola is a big one. Soy, corn. Those are big crops. Wheat, barley, oats, those are crops that are grown on large acres, and also pulse crops. And those are things like lentils and peas and chickpeas. So those are the kinds of crops that the big companies really want to be able to control the seed, because they can make a lot of money on them. They're not as interested in controlling what you might call garden seeds or vegetable seeds, because those markets are a lot smaller. And there still is hybridized vegetable seeds. And when you go to buy seeds for your own garden in the springtime, you'll find that there are some seeds that are hybrids. So you could save the seed, but it wouldn't be consistent, just like the hybrid corn was. You might say, oh, this is a really great kind of broccoli. I really like how it grew in my garden and it tasted really good. You save some seed, and next year it doesn't really perform the way you expected. That's because it was a hybrid. And then some seeds have what they call plant breeders' rights attached to them. And that is like a patent. It's a little bit different from a patent, but it has a similar effect. You're not allowed to save the seed and plant it if you're growing it commercially without getting permission and paying a royalty. But those plant breeders' rights don't apply to home gardens. So you don't really have to worry about that if you're a home gardener. But if you're a commercial market garden and you're selling your crop on the market, then you would have to obey the plant breeders' rights rules about seed. But most of the seed for vegetable crops is not grown in Canada. We have a very, very small Canadian vegetable seed production. And this has to do with, for one thing, our government has decided not to fund this kind of seed research and doesn't really support developing varieties that are particularly good at growing in Canada. So we rely on seed from other countries. And also seed production is quite, for vegetable seeds, it's quite labor intensive. It's very hands-on, and labor in Canada is expensive. So we get seed for vegetables that is grown in other countries. It's owned by some very big European companies are the main ones that are in vegetable seeds. And they actually get a lot of their production done in the global south, where they don't have to pay as much for labor. So it's actually kind of an exploitive situation. So we're doubly, we don't have seed sovereignty over these kinds of vegetable seeds, and they are produced in a situation of exploitation. So what is really important is having local Canadian farms that grow seed for vegetable production. And we do have some people doing this, and they often are using what we call open source or open pollinated seed. And that is seed that is not affected by patents or plant breeders' rights, and heritage seeds. They're traditional. And so people who are growing those seeds, they're doing a really important service for our Canadian food system. And there are quite a few local food community people, like people that are growing, say, market gardens and community shared agriculture, food production, and growing for communities for direct marketing, farmers markets, who are dedicated to using local seed that's open source, that's maybe it's organic. And this is a way to have seed sovereignty by using the seed that doesn't have these corporate controls on it. But the kinds of vegetables that you get in the grocery store are likely either imported from another country, or if they're grown in Canada, they would probably be grown with seed that was purchased in bulk from another country.
I guess my follow-up question is, you were talking about these open source seeds and things like that. What can we do about the seeds that are very largely under corporate control? I mean, it sounds like they're probably needed as well in our agricultural systems. So how can we improve seed sovereignty for those varieties and for those plants?
Well, one of the things that the National Farmers Union has been working on for many years, going back actually right to around 1970 when the organization was first established, is that we have been opposing plant breeders' rights legislation, which is a way for companies to claim control over seed through a legal measure. And we've had several campaigns over the years whenever plant breeders' rights have been proposed or tightened up and shifting more and more power over to the corporations. And we have really done a great job in Canada of slowing down that whole process. But these corporations don't give up. They want access to that market. They want to control the market. They want to be able to create those kinds of monopolies so that they can make more money. And another thing what they're trying to do when they're developing some of these seeds, it's not only selling the seeds and getting the royalties that they want, but they also are selling farm chemicals like pesticides, like herbicides, and seed coatings that are insecticidal seed coatings, and fungicides that are against plant diseases. So they actually don't mind if their seed varieties are susceptible to some of these problems, because then they can sell people the chemicals to solve those problems. So there's a bit of a conflict of interest there. So we've been very, very vocal and active in the National Farmers Union to push back whenever those kinds of laws or regulations are proposed or tightened up. But we've also put together an alternative idea, and this would be a Farmers Seed Act. And so we've written, it's on our website, it's called Fundamental Principles of a Farmers Seed Act, and it was written by one of our former presidents, Terry Boehm, a number of years ago. And it talks about how farmers need to have the right to save seed and also select, exchange, reuse, and sell seed without having corporate control. And that, you know, it should be the farmers that are in charge of how seed is used and what seed is available. And there is actually an international treaty called the United Nations Treaty on Plant Genetic Resources for Food and Agriculture that actually protects this right, but Canada is not observing it, or they're interpreting it in a way that allows them to promote this corporate control of seed. So fighting back, it's largely a political battle. And so we always raise awareness when there's an issue, and we help people become informed and help them understand what they can do to try and keep these, you know, bad laws from being put in place. But I guess some other things that people can do on a more personal level is look for the kinds of products, support the kinds of products in the when you're buying food that are generally using the non-genetically modified seed that isn't subject to patents, and open source local varieties like you would find for vegetables. And often this is certified organic production, because certified organic prohibits using GMOs, and that was brought in, I think, mostly for, you know, concerns about the environment and health, but it also reduces the amount of control that corporations have over the food supply, which is another important value that I think a lot of organic farmers share. And the local food movement is really part of the values that the local food movement has, is to make sure that we can feed ourselves, that we are not going to be dependent on imports from another country. We're not going to be dependent on production that is using underpaid labor or people that are working under terrible conditions, because we've got, you know, better standards here in Canada than some other countries. And we want things to be fresh, and we want to support our own local economies. We don't want our food dollars to all be going to some foreign country, some big corporation. We want it to go to the people that actually grow the food. And these values are very consistent with using open source and local, locally produced seed. And also the locally produced seed can adapt to our changing climate and can be viable here. And that's a very important aspect of the seed issue, is like we need to have the ability to select and find seed that works well in our climate without using genetic modification that ends up being in corporate hands. So So that's another good reason to look for those producers and products that are using the open source and local seeds.
That's awesome. And it's so interesting to hear how seed sovereignty can really feed in not just to a better climate situation, but climate justice all around, like a more holistic mm-hmm. view.
Exactly.
Thank you so much for joining us today on Ravel Radio. And you have a wonderful rest of your day, Kathy.
Yeah, thanks a lot. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Was Rabble Labor reporter Gabriella Kaluge-Kasuga and Kathy Holtzlander, the Director of Research and Policy for the National Farmers Union, in conversation. Thanks so much for that, Gabby and Kathy. To read Gabby's full analysis of this issue, please visit rabble.ca. Now it's time for a segment we like to call In Case You Missed It, and for that, let's turn it over to Rabble editor Nick Seabrook. Over to you, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. In national news, the Supreme Court of Canada is being accused of anti-Black and anti-Palestinian racism after three Black delegates were barred from meeting with court clerks over their pro-Palestinian social media activity. The delegates were invited as a part of a group led by former Governor General Michael Jean that was presenting to the court law clerks on the issue of anti-Black racism. Just hours before the meeting was scheduled to take place, Court Registrar Chantal Charbonneau informed L. Jones, Derek O'Simons, and Benazir Erdemi that they were being barred from the meeting due to their pro-Palestinian activity on social media. In an interview with Rabble, Jones stated that the court never identified which of her social media posts they found objectionable and defended her ethical stance on Palestine. In labor news, Saskatchewan teachers continue to fight for a new contract. Since May 2023, teachers in Saskatchewan have demanded that their new contract make provisions for the growing number of students in classes and their increasingly complex needs. Currently, the provincial government has not given its negotiators permission to change its initial offer of a 7% pay increase over 3 years and refused to discuss the need for changes in the classroom, leaving negotiations at an impasse. Lack of proper government funds has not only affected the size of classrooms, but also created a lack of supports for students. There is currently only one psychologist available for every 2,900 students, and only one social worker available for every 2,600 students. In feminist news, Joyce Arthur, the founder and executive director of the Abortion Rights Coalition of Canada, is reminding Canadians to be vigilant of far-right anti-choice extremism in Canada. While limits on the access to abortion continue to grow in the U.S. in the wake of institutionalized right-wing extremism, Arthur warns that it is important to remain vigilant in Canada, despite access to abortion being protected under the Canada Health Act. Arthur writes, quote, "Right-wing extremism always makes women's rights and 2S LGBTQIA plus rights a priority target for attack," end quote. Arthur points to the failed Bill C-311, which every Conservative MP voted for, which would have restricted access to abortion by granting unprecedented rights to a fetus. Bill C-311 failed to pass a vote in the House of Commons in January of last year. In Alberta news, CTV Calgary is under fire for sharing an anti-abortion poll of questionable origin. The poll claims to show a majority of Albertans are in favor of requiring a parent being informed if their underage child is seeking an abortion. The poll was allegedly conducted by National Public Research Canada. Prime Contact Research Group, which owns a similarly named yet unrelated polling company called Canadian National Public Research, slammed CTV Calgary for failing to do its due diligence before sharing the poll as fact in a recent news story. A story by The Progress Report shows that the company that conducted the poll is owned by Alberta Blue Strategies, a conservative voter call center run by conservative activist Richard Durr. In Rabble News, let's deconstruct whiteness on and off the Hill. It's Black History Month, and this month on Off the Hill, let's talk about whiteness. What is it, where did it come from, and how does it impact federal policy? Guests this month include poet and activist Elle Jones, social responsibility and equity communications consultant Baizan Zubi, and assistant professor in the Faculty of Social Work Fritz Pino, co-hosted by Robin Brown and Libby Davies. Don't miss out. Register for this event with a link on rabble.ca. And finally, students at schools across Alberta engaged in walkouts this week in response to Premier Danielle Smith's proposed anti-trans policies. Smith recently announced that she intended to enact policies that would bar transgender youth from accessing gender-affirming care and require students to receive permission from parents before being allowed to use their correct pronouns in school. According to the Alberta Walkout organizers, around 2,000 students from 50 schools across the province participated. This number is estimated to be higher, as some schools have yet to be recorded. To read the full version of all the stories we talked about today, please visit rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to Rabble Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. If you have feedback for the show, ideas, stories, opinions you'd like us to cover, we'd love to hear about it. Get in touch with us anytime at editor@rabble.ca. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.
Speaker Series, presented by the SFU Open Source Development Club, is an exciting event for all tech enthusiasts. Join us on an in-person gathering where we dive into the world of open source development. Immerse yourself in a vibrant community of like-minded individuals interested in exploring the endless possibilities of this ever-evolving field. Broaden your knowledge, gain valuable insights, and connect with experts in the industry, including guest speaker Charles Stone, CEO of Cynic Software and Haymate. Don't miss out on this incredible opportunity to run, share, and grow together. Admission is free. Register online at osdevspeakerone.eventbrite.ca.